Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Wilder, along with Curtis McGiffin. Jim Petrosky, Jim is, at his age, he's getting a bit older, so he's got to take long vacations. And so, that's what he's doing. He's resting. So he's not with us today. So Curtis and I will have another discussion. And we were looking at the news this week, Curtis, and
yes.
We sort of scanned through the news. And there were a handful of articles. I mean, I would say that the dominant theme this week in the news has been Golden Dome.
Yes.
The president signed an executive order. Congress has been working on language that we've seen. So we're looking to see how will it be funded. There's a lot going on. Industry's excited to know what's going to happen because industry is, of course, going to want to build it. So they're looking at that. So Golden Dome's been a big topic. There was also an article that came out by, Dan News and Der Spiegel. Apparently, the Russians had on their public websites, and I think it was their acquisition sort of function in the Russian Defense Ministry, where they had all sorts of plans for their nuclear facilities that were, available on these websites. And so I assume, as I read the article, what they're saying is that, for Russian companies that want to, contracts to build components of these nuclear facilities, like the drawings, the schematics, all this stuff was there. And so Der Spiegel and this other organization pulled down, they said, like 2 million pages of detailed documents about exactly what these facilities look like, the security capabilities, all of that. And so we're now getting, a very detailed look at, what the Russians are building and what this proves, and sort of the big picture component is that the Russians are modernizing everything. And much of it is already done. And so the idea that, the Russians may not have modernized their nuclear infrastructure, we now know that's just not true because we've seen it all, and what they're seeing on satellite imagery is consistent with what these documents show. And so, they're still going through like 2 million pages of documents. So keep an eye on that, listeners, because, that may, and the analysis of it, because it may prove that there is a lot of good stuff out there. And keep an eye on Golden Dome. Those would kind of be the two big things I'd say, for news this week.
So are you telling me, Adam, that it wasn't the Russians' plan to stick the new Sarmat in 65-year-old missile silos like America's plan was?
That's 100% correct. what they're saying is they're saying that they have literally built their missile bases. From the ground up, they've been rebuilt. New facilities, new underground structures, new everything. Well, and so, and what's funny is if you look at the Russian economy is about, it's less than 10% the size of ours. It's mm-hmm. about 1/10 the size of the U.S. economy. And so this is where they're finding, this is where they're putting their eggs, is in this basket. Because,
correct.
The Russians know and understand that they're never going to match the U.S. conventionally. So what do you do to deter or coerce the U.S.? Well, you have a superior strategic and tactical nuclear arsenal. And so that's what they're doing. That's exactly what they're doing. It's a Russian version of the New Look policy.
Yeah, there you go. You can always tell what's most important to a nation by what they spend the most money on. And so you can look at that and determine pretty clearly, as you said, that is a priority for them. They have chosen to prioritize their nuclear deterrent, which really is coercive weapon systems, but nonetheless, they have chosen to prioritize their nuclear deterrent while we in America continue to debate it and piecemeal it. So, yeah, it'll be very interesting as people sort of refine this. We'll wait. We'll look for the Mark Schneider piece on this when he actually does all the analysis. Yeah, he's pretty exactly. good at this stuff. So
exactly. There was also there was a great article by Kyle Balzer. It was in The Hill on the 28th, and it was called U.S. Withdrawal from Europe Won't Solve the China Threat. And in it, Kyle makes, you know, the argument that the U.S. should not withdraw not only, you know, portions of American forces, but the entire American force from Europe, from NATO, in order to sort of focus our attention on China. And that, you know, that's sort of one of the big fears that both the Europeans and sort of the Trump detractors have said, is that, you know, he's going to pull us out of all of these, all of the, you know, out of NATO and potentially out of South Korea and other places. And then, of course, there are those who say, and Kyle calls it the prioritizers. And those are the ones like Elbridge Colby, the Undersecretary for Policy, who have said, you know, hey, we don't need to worry about Europe. We need to focus on Asia, and therefore we need to shift our forces from Europe to Asia. And, you know, that's what we need to do. And, of course, Kyle says, well, no, we shouldn't do that. And we shouldn't do that because if you do that, then Russia may begin to act far more aggressively towards NATO European members, which would only draw us back into a conflict with Russia, and therefore you created a worse problem, because then you're going to have to, you know, wage war against the Russians in Europe, and that'll be far more difficult and far more demanding than maintaining a force that's capable in size and capability to deter Russia in the first place. And so it's a pretty good argument. I liked his argument, and I was just, you know, sort of curious, what was your take on Kyle's argument?
Yeah, so I understand where he's coming from on this. I disagree with some of this some of his logic, and I'd like to just sort of review a little bit of that. So he refers to this to some reports that the Pentagon is considering. Okay, let me use that word, considering withdrawing 10,000 troops from Europe. This is from a report in NBC News in early April, so it's about 2 months old now. And so there's some gnashing of teeth by Kyle in this article over this. And I would argue here that this is a, you know, that the numbers vary. Some outlets report there's about 65,000 American troops in Europe today, some 80,000. I'll say that in 2014, when Russia first invaded Ukraine, Crimea, the estimate of U.S. troops in NATO Europe was about 65,000. So we've really not added much, all right, if anything. And then I would say that so a $10,000 troop reduction is about 12 to 15%, depending upon which number you're using, right? What organization can't withstand a 12% reduction of anything? And I'll remind everybody that with the addition of Sweden and Finland, that was an additional 40,000 active duty troops between the two countries together. And collectively...
Wait a second. So you're telling me that two new NATO members combined are significantly less than the U.S. contribution in Europe.
Correct. But still significant. But the addition of them is significantly more than what is being considered for removal or redeployment home or redeployment to Asia. So I would argue that. But when you put NATO collectively together, they're over a million troops. Active duty wise.
Yeah.
If you include the reserves, you're about 1.5 million troops in NATO. I am pretty sure 10,000 Americans isn't going to make that much of a difference. Let's also keep in mind that of the 65,000 Americans that are in Europe, a great amount of them are staff guys running UCOM, Shape, AFRICOM. So let's realize that if we just moved the AFRICOM headquarters out of Europe, you would remove probably 5,000-ish, maybe. I don't know the numbers of AFRICOM headquarters. I'm kind of guessing here, but a good portion of that 10,000 would just be moving that headquarters to somewhere else. So, let's not get overly excited about, you know, troop reductions. And again, it's not going to happen. This is speculation. Who knows? This speculation in NBC News was by anonymous sources who may have been feeding the news cycle to get Europe to read that. They go, oh my gosh, we need to pay more, right? Because we don't want the Americans to leave.
Yeah, I mean, part of this, if you know, one of the things that whenever Donald Trump, you know, does, if you want to call it negotiation, we'll call it negotiation. So it seems to me that he's taking his business practice mm-hmm. of sort of hardball negotiation, which is, you know, historically, we don't have business leaders become presidents. You know, historically, it's governors. You know, governors are the number one source of
right.
of future presidents. You know, we've had senators, you know, but we tend not to have, you know, business leaders. And we tend not to have sort of hardball real estate guys from New York City who are in the White House. And so I oftentimes look at anything Trump does is in some respects is the way you and I see, you know, nuclear negotiations or nuclear capability structuring, is that you push as hard as you can with the expectation that you're gonna meet somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I think Donald Trump's negotiation style is that he'll push hard to then knowing that he's gonna wind up with less.
Yeah.
And that by doing that, and then what everybody does is they take everything he says as, you know, sort of the one and only position that he'll take. You know, it's, you know, we want, you know, Greenland. Well, maybe he doesn't actually want Greenland, but what he actually wants is a larger presence in Greenland.
Right. Unfettered,
you know, so
access.
If you think about unfettered, you know, so there's all of these ways to negotiate that I don't understand. It's sort of like with Vladimir Putin. Whenever Vladimir Putin makes a nuclear threat, people don't throw their hands up and say nuclear war is going to happen tomorrow. They say, well, this is, you know, this is an effort to try to convince the Americans not participate. And they sort of excuse away Vladimir Putin's nuclear threats. But when it comes to being Donald Trump, everything he says is his only position. It's not a negotiation. And I don't understand why people won't give Donald Trump the same leeway as they give Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping or anybody else, because that's sort of what we're talking about. So when it comes to Europe, Donald Trump clearly wants Europe, and rightfully so, to take a stronger position in its own defense. And it's not just its own defense. You know, it's if you look at tariffs. So the United States has always had lower tariffs on European imports than the Europeans have had on American exports. Well, Donald Trump is now saying, hey, you know, I want the same or similar tariffs that on our goods coming to Europe as we've had on your goods coming to the United States. He's now saying, hey, I want you to take a bigger role in your own defense. And so it's this constant, you know, sort of push for the Europeans. And maybe it's like if you think about today where you've got adult children who have never left home and are living in the basement. And it's sort of, you know, they made a great movie about it. It's called Failure to Launch. It's got Matthew McConaughey. And the parents want to push him out of the house and he doesn't want to go. Well, this is, you know, Donald Trump is the parents. And he's in Europe is, you know, Matthew McConaughey, and he sort of wants them to, you know, to push him out of the house. It doesn't mean he doesn't love them, and it doesn't mean he doesn't want to be partners and they can't come back. It means none of that. but it means they need to take a stronger role that is off the American dole, whether it's via tariffs. You know, if you look at like drug pricing, you know, the U.S. subsidizes the cost of prescription drugs for the rest of the world. We've always subsidized it because we have the highest drug prices, because we don't have governments that have set drug prices. And therefore, to when it comes to the $4 billion it takes to develop a new prescription drug, that's always borne by Americans, while Europeans, for example, pay 20 to 30% of what we pay. And now Donald Trump is saying no more of that. And so this is sort of trying to teach the Europeans to be better at adulting than they have been, because they've been used to us supporting them.
Well, it's definitely time to end the Marshall Plan, and so I certainly can concede that. You know, Kyle dutifully notes, though, in his article that the U.S. does find itself in a period of resource scarcity, and then it might have to shift warfighting assets from Europe to Asia. But he thinks it's a bad idea, and then Washington and its NATO allies might have to rely more on nuclear employment. So we've seen this before. It's called the first offset of the 1950s, massive retaliation, and the Europeans loved that. They were very unhappy when America switched under the Kennedy administration to flexible response and forced this conventional rearming of Europe. They did not like that. It was they had to be drug along to do that. We're kind of seeing that again, maybe. But I think in this reality, we do have an issue here. And of course, Bridge Colby, who is the number three in the Pentagon, is a big China hawk and believes that is where the next the next battle will be. Now, I think Kyle intimates in his piece here that, hey, look, you know, the Army may not have a large role to play in the Pacific, so we don't necessarily need to move them, because that's really a naval war. So if that's true, then really the worry for NATO is, how are they going to backfill the lack of American naval capacity? But I think the problem is bigger than that. It's really about the Air Force capacity, which would have to support a conflict on both continents. It's a tyranny of distance. We know we have tanker support limitations. Again, a lack of capacity to do the things we want. This is what we refer to, Adam, and I know you know this, but our listeners may not, as the Lippmann Gap, right? You're familiar with the Lippmann Gap, right? Which is when you have interests and strategies that are larger than the capabilities and resources that you've assigned to them. You've created this huge gap. Your eyes are bigger than your stomach when you're at the buffet, right? You just it's sort of in the reverse, right? I want all this, but I can't really feed it all. I can't do it all, and so we struggle with that. And it's even harder when you have a $37-38 trillion debt and a $1 trillion deficit running every 3 to 6 months, depending upon how you're calculating. So this is a real challenge. This is a real challenge. America cannot be everywhere all the time anymore, because we simply can't afford it. And a broke America, financially broke America, serves no one except the Chinese. So we have to work these resources accordingly. And perhaps a more pervasive use of our nuclear, and I say use, threatened deployment, whatever you want to call it, of our nuclear capability to offset some of these gaps may be real. But Adam, let me ask you this. Should America go to a hot war with China? What's NATO's role in that? Are they going to come and fight with us? Or could we at least just ask them to sort of hold up their end of the bargain on that continent while we fight this war over here? Because it's most likely that if we go to a hot war with China, Russia will engage and try to either take an opportunistic aggression, right? Take advantage of the time frame and maybe try to pick off a country or two in Europe, or at least just helping their ally by trying to tie us down in Europe by dividing our resources. Thoughts?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I try to put myself in the European shoes and I try to think of what are the Europeans, you know, logically, what should they be telling themselves? So Europeans have to understand that the U.S. has to focus on China. China is a much larger economy than the Soviets ever were.
Right.
It's more prosperous.
Right.
It's, you know, it's got, you know, more than three times the people that the Soviet Union ever had. It's just a much more challenging adversary for the United States. And so for Europe, which has an economy significantly larger than the Russian economy, right? If you look at European NATO, its economy rivals that of the United States, you know? And so therefore this idea that the U.S. is abandoning Europe, that, the, you know, that, that Europe can't stand on its own, that it just, it's unfathomable because Europe has the resources, it has the people, it has the technology, and it doesn't mean that the U.S. is somehow maliciously abandoning Europe. But the United States is a nation that borrows 35% of its budget every year, and it now has a debt servicing payment every year that's the size of the defense budget
or larger.
And they want to keep expanding the deficit because that's how you pay for. I mean, there are things you have to do. You have to have defense. You have to have a full, you know, you have to have a State Department. You have to have, what you don't have to have are entitlement programs. Nowhere in the U.S. Constitution is there a requirement to give people free health care, which 25% of Americans now get through Medicaid. That's not a requirement. Defense is a requirement that is put in specifically into the Constitution. Yet we want to have all the free stuff because it's how you buy votes. It's literally a vote buying scheme. But then there's the things we also have to do. And if you look at entitlement programs, they are now $4 trillion of the $5 trillion that the U.S. brings in every year. They're also 50% of the state's budgets. So they're 80% of the federal budget. They're 50% of the state budgets. They're over $6 trillion a year in spending. And unless we deal with that, then how does Kyle or anyone else who says stay in Europe, keep doing all these other things, oh, and what, just keep borrowing $2 to $3 trillion a year? And then what happens when debt servicing is half the federal budget, which it will be if we keep at this rate within a decade or so? It's just not sustainable. So something has to give. So for the defense, you know, if you want to call them experts, but if for all of those who are advocates of a robust defense, you can't talk about defense in a vacuum, because defense doesn't operate in a vacuum.
That's right.
It operates within the context of the entire federal budget. So you're going to need to start making the argument for why we have to cut entitlement programs, because they've overwhelmed the federal budget. But like I said, they're 80% of the budget, and then debt servicing is 20%. So entitlements and debt repayment are 100% of federal revenue. And then when it comes to defense and state and commerce and all those other things, that's what we're currently paying for with borrowed dollars every year. The solution is to cut entitlements and focus on what the Constitution requires the federal government to do. That's the solution. And we need defense people to start talking about this instead of shying away from it because it's politically unpalatable.
I think this goes to Kyle's argument of prioritization, right? And I've talked about prioritization in many of our podcasts. You know, when we talk about nuclear modernization, I always say we can do this if we make it a priority. And I mean by a national priority. And I think this is all the same. And your point about the financial distress that is clearly informs every decision that is made, whether you are adding or subtracting from that equation. We simply have a problem now that if you take out 20 years of war on terror and an over response to COVID, you remove a third of this debt. So again, yes, when we talk about the debt, about spending it on things that are not in the Constitution, we also spend things unnecessarily out of fear or ignorance or political response to problem sets, and it creates huge, huge deficits and debts. And the reality is, between the war and COVID, you're talking about $13 to $14 trillion worth of spending in this century. That didn't have to happen, right?
No, 100%.
So we are living with bad political decisions from both parties, and they affect not only how Americans live, but apparently, according to Kyle, it affects how the Europeans live. So we have to remember this. And so he says here in a closing paragraph here, he says, prioritization is a necessary ingredient in any sound strategy. Yes, actually, it's foundational. Strategies are about prioritizing. Is that the right word? Prioritization and the act of prioritizing.
Prioritizing.
It's early morning. I haven't had all my coffee yet. And so the point here is that this is why you get paid the big bucks. Okay. Prioritization is what makes this job hard. If you don't, then everything's possible, right? Because you have unlimited resources and therefore you can have unlimited appetites. You have no Lippmann gap. And that just simply is not reality.
Well, but isn't that what, this is part of what I think has been a larger problem has been the fact that there's no accountability for decisions.
That's true.
This is why I would love for all politicians to be fiduciaries. And a fiduciary has to act in the best interest of their client. They cannot act in their own interest. And if they're being deemed to have acted in their own interest as opposed to their client's interest, they can be, held civilly and criminally accountable. That's what we don't do with politicians. When politicians make terrible policies that are harmful to the American people, we simply just elect, we either reelect them or we just elect new ones who do the same thing. And we hold no one accountable. So when we've now spent, we're what, $7 trillion into the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and have absolutely nothing to show for it.
Right.
Who was held accountable for that?
No one.
Or the COVID funding that we know that at least 30% of all COVID funding was lost to fraud, much of it overseas. Who's been held accountable for that?
That's right.
The problem is both the political elites and sort of the intellectual elites that funnel in and out of think tanks and government, they're failures. They are abject failures. And none of them have been held accountable. And so what do? They keep doing the same thing. When are we going to talk about eliminating a $2 trillion annual deficit? And who's going to be held accountable for saddling us and our children with that debt? Nobody. Right. We've always known that Social Security was a Ponzi scheme. It's built exactly like one. But yet, what do? Because people want money, we just keep it up. And eventually it'll collapse. But we'll run it till it does. We're going to do. So right. We need accountability. And this idea that Europe, that we can't leave Europe or that we can't even cut in Europe because the Russians will attack. There's potentially some truth to that, but it's also a fact that we have to face hard realities and hard choices. And we put ourselves in this position, and now we've got to deal with it.
Let's remind everybody that Putin has waged war in Ukraine for 3 years and hasn't taken Kyiv. He's not going to take a NATO country, whether the Americans are there or not. He just cannot do it. And the Europeans are the EU has announced that they are going to go on a $900 billion spending spree for defense spending. To Russian eyes and ears, that looks like a massive buildup by their most strategic adversary. So there may be more problems coming as a result of trying to fix this problem. But nonetheless, it is where we are going. And the solution here, there are many solutions, all of them probably distasteful. But if you're one of those listeners out there who thinks that we spend way too much money on military spending, then I would offer to you that if 6 to 10% of our defense budget is on the nuclear enterprise, not only maintaining what we have, but adding the modernization as well, if you simply double that, you can probably reduce the conventional side of the military in magnitudes larger than that percentage. So if you want to cut the military budget, you could get really large in nukes, pull back, go back to a new look policy of massive retaliation, and see what happens. And let the locals, i.e. the regional allies, do the conventional dirty work,
conventional
so to speak. That's right. So yeah, there are ways to do this if you prioritize correctly, Kyle. Yeah. So great article, Kyle. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to talk about this incredibly important subject and allowing us to elaborate on your thoughts. And so keep it up.
All right. Well, another great discussion. Thanks again, Curtis. I'm sure Jim will be back the next episode. We'll see. I think we should let Jim pick the next topic. You know, he's been out a while, so we'll let Jim pick the topic.
He's
going
to want to discuss the thermal dynamics of whale watching.
Yes, that's a topic he's interested in, very much so. So, but thanks again. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners. Check us out on, you know, Global Security Review, you know, all the different, you know, the podcasts, QC events, all the stuff we put out. Keep listening, keep reading. Yeah, Curtis is on X. He tweets really good every day. He puts quite a bit of time into finding just the right articles with just the right thoughts behind them. Thanks for doing that. And of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.